Off the Ball, GAA.
It was great to give our football supporters a fantastic day out. You know, we knew all the lads there nearly by name that have followed us the length and breadth of the country.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
All right, you're very welcome along. It's Tuesday morning and we've a really busy show for you. Gordon Darcy is going to join us in studio around about 9:15 talking about his new kids book and some other stuff that's happened at Leinster this week. Tommy Rooney's going to look at the losers of the football championship. I think the power rankings are coming out today, if I'm not mistaken, so you'll find out what he thinks of the winners, of course, as well. Seamus Flanagan is with us already in studio, so we'll talk hurling with him a little bit later on as well. And we also say good morning to Enda and Matthew. Gentlemen, how are you?
How's it going?
Very good.
It's Mbappe's world, it's Leo Messi's world, it's everybody except Cristiano Ronaldo's world. Haaland scored twice as well last night. Like, not a bad day's football, really.
No.
When you think about it.
The timings were actually all right as well. It was all quite watchable, even for us, to a degree.
Once I went 1-0 in the Iraq game and they were absolutely hammering, they were all like, I will watch the end of this.
Fair point. I said that. I didn't watch the end of the France game. I did go to bed. It was slightly too much, but yeah, I got to watch the Argentina.
Oh, sorry, Mo Salah as well.
Salah as well, yeah.
You keep forgetting these 24 hours. Like, there's five games.
Caught the last...
Previous nights before. Nico Lopez in the back of all the papers. Like, but that was weeks ago.
Yeah. It's 2 days ago. I caught the last 20 minutes of Algeria and Jordan on my way in this morning as well.
Oh, yeah.
It's a real cracker.
He was raging. He missed the...
I had it on my phone on the way in, and then I got to the door of the office and I turned it off, and then I walked up the stairs and came in and Algeria scored. And then nothing happened for the rest
Huge
of the game.
Huge moment.
Yeah. Right, so it's raging. It's raging.
The Mo Salah one's going to be an interesting one probably to look back on in 20 years' time in terms of his Egyptian career as opposed to his club career, because he is one of those players that slightly unfortunate that his country didn't really match up in quality in comparison to what his talent may have achieved. But he probably has also underachieved for Egypt as well. Like, he hasn't really performed to the levels that a Messi or, like, say, a Gareth Bale did for Wales, dragging them beyond where they reasonably would have expected to go.
They're going
to
get out of this group though, right?
Looks that way.
Yeah.
They nearly won a couple of AFCONs as well, didn't they?
Yeah, come on, Enda. Jesus Christ. Mo Salah, shit career, says Enda.
That's the title. Right,
that's how headlines happen, yeah. I'm not saying he had a shit career for Egypt. I'm saying it'll be slightly disappointed if he finishes his Egypt career without a trophy.
I mean, they're very unlikely to win this entire, but they are now currently top of their group after Belgium's
terrible
scrappy
group.
Draw the other day. So Egypt have 4 points, Iran have two, Belgium have two, and New Zealand have one, so they're obviously guaranteed to go through at this point as one of the, and they might have a reasonable draw. This might be his moment.
I doubt it.
They might have a run. Was it Carragher said that one time or something about Salah not performing for Egypt or not achieving that for Egypt, and he got absolutely ripped for it. That was like the start of the kind of that relationship with the
souring.
Yeah, if it even is a relationship, but I think that I remember that in Monday Night Football. But Ronaldo does have a chance tonight though to follow suit against Uzbekistan, so we'll see what he has to offer.
If ever someone was built for a hat-trick against Uzbekistan, it's 41-year-old Cristiano.
Yeah, but that's the thing, he can't win. He goes and scores a hat-trick against Uzbekistan and everyone's like, yeah, sure, it's Uzbekistan. Yeah, you know, like, what can he do?
Well, score the hat-trick and, like, if, you know...
Yeah, true.
Get a bit of form back, get a bit of confidence into the team.
Yeah.
Because I'm still convinced they have the best midfield in the competition and they're not playing like it.
Yeah, maybe on paper they do, yeah. Yeah. Well, Vitinha and Jean Neves and Bruno.
Yeah, they're brilliant. Mm. And there's other players who were around there. You want to push Bruno up a bit further.
Yeah. No, they should definitely be better than they were the last day. But it's funny though, the group stages are one of those things where you can have a slow start and it not really matter, but you can also have a really fast start. If you win that first game, you're almost guaranteed to get through with the way the format is now. So if you don't win that first game, there's that added bit of pressure. I'd still be incredibly shocked if Portugal did manage to get out of group. But there's pressure on this game tonight, because if they don't manage to get a win here, then they might actually be in a bit of bother. In Uzbekistan, I don't think we're awful against Colombia. I'm not going to pretend I stood up and watched it at 3 o'clock in the morning, but I saw the highlights back and looked at it a little bit about them.
Yeah. Yeah, they weren't totally useless. No. Hang on, this is Cannavaro's managing them, is he?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, that guy, so he looks, and then I was like, oh, okay, it's actually Fabio Cannavaro.
Yeah.
He looks pretty good.
Kusunov as well, is obviously in Manchester City, centre half. Bit of Cannavaro about him, small kind of.
It's slightly unnerving seeing all the players that you grew up watching now being the old heads in the dugouts or in the stands. I saw was it Muller and who was in the stands with him?
Which Muller now? Thomas Muller.
Thomas Muller.
I didn't see who was standing beside him.
Thomas Muller was in the stands alongside the former Germany, Borussia Dortmund, names escaping me, captain.
Mats Hummels,
exactly. They were supposed to stand together. This is absolutely diluting my point here, but the commentary said, is that Miroslav Klose by any chance in the stands?
Yeah.
Neither of those look like Miroslav Klose. In the commentary's defence, Muller is rocking a big beard now, so yeah. Duck.
I like Thomas Muller. He's a good player. He was class. I remember he was like the World Cup guy for a while.
He was the world, and I loved the way he carried himself as well. He just wore his heart in his sleeves.
Yeah,
as well.
No, he's cool.
So overnight, Leo Messi now two clear of Miroslav Klose at the top of the all-time goal-scoring charts. Haven't scored twice in that game. But what also happened was Mbappe went level with Klose.
Yeah.
Pretty good.
I was reading this morning, he's played 8 less games than Klose as well at the minute, Mbappe.
Yes, actually, so I have
12 fewer than Messi.
Yeah, that is outrageous.
I have the list here if you want it.
Yeah, go for it. I was looking at it. So.
Yeah, so Leo Messi, he could have had a hat-trick. He missed a penalty as well. Yeah. It was a very poor penalty. It's one of those weird things that the greatest player of all time is just not that good at the easiest part of the game.
I was looking at his, because the first game when he had his penalty as well, it was showing like his stats. Yeah. His stats are horrendous for penalties.
Yeah,
are we still taking penalties for
Argentina? No one's going to take it off now, are they?
Yeah. Absolutely no one, but I couldn't get over his stats for penalties with Argentina and with club. It's horrendous.
Yeah, I think they threw out a stat. I think he's like 77% penalty success rate, so he misses 1 in 4.
Yeah.
It's not great. It's not great for the greatest player of all time. So Leo Messi, he's top of this list with 18 goals in 28 games. We've got Kylian Mbappe then level with Miroslav Klose, both on 16 goals, but the caveat here is that Mbappe has played 16 games versus Miroslav Klose's 24. Then we've got Ronaldo Rosario, who has 15 goals in 19 games. Jared Muller, 14 goals in 13 games. Jose Fontaine, 13 goals in 6 games.
Yeah, you got them all in one tournament.
Yeah. And then the great Pele, 12 goals in 14 games. So looks like Kylian Mbappe is probably going to be the top scorer at the World Cup, potentially by the end of this tournament, in very, very few amount of games.
Mm.
It helps when you score a hat-trick in your first World Cup final. You're off to a good start there.
Well, was this first?
Second.
Was it second World Cup?
He scored in the first one as well.
He
scored a crack, remember that, to the bottom left. He was only 18 at that World Cup as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was outrageously good.
What happened to France in the 1958 World Cup that they didn't win it? Who beat them?
I don't know.
Like, how did they have just Fontaine scoring 13 goals in 6 games and not win it? Brazil beat them 5-2 in the semi.
Wonder did he score like 7 in a game or something?
Pelé's Brazil beat them.
It is surprising when you look back at, I suppose this is the modern game where you're talking about stats so much with, like, obviously Kylian Mbappe, that looks like such an impressive record. But say for the likes of Diego Maradona, like the, was it the 1986?
Yeah.
World Cup of Mexico. He only scored 2 goals at that tournament.
No, he scored 2 goals in the game against England and he scored against Belgium.
Did he? Okay, maybe I looked at that. Maybe it was the tournament.
Italy.
Maybe it was the tournament after that or before that. There was one tournament he only scored 2 goals at.
Maybe the Italy one is 1990. Of course, an equaliser against it. It's brilliant. Ball pops up.
I was looking through the stats this morning, so I should have made note of it, the proper thing. But yeah, like he wasn't prolific. Like the greatest players of all time have not scored that many goals at these tournaments. It's pretty hard to score goals at World Cups.
And this one is definitely bucking the trend. Maybe that's because the quality of opposition isn't as good. Maybe that's what happens when you have 48 teams, that you get the opportunities for these lads to pad their stats.
Mm. Algeria and Austria tend to qualify quite regularly.
In fairness, they're,
I think he's just primed for it, really, isn't he? He's essentially had 3.5 years...
Of rest.
I was going to say no disrespect to the MLS, but like all disrespect to the MLS, like it's not a proper standard of football. Like it is a retirement home, but you can use that to benefit other aspects of your career, and it seems like he's done that.
Yeah, and he definitely, I think he definitely looked at it like that as well, hasn't he?
Yeah, I think so.
Their season, the breakdown of their season as well, how little games he needs to play.
And he hasn't played in ages either.
That's what I'm saying. He can just prime himself for back to back.
I think they have a rule as well that you have to fly coach. That you can't fly. But I wonder, do they break that rule for Messi? Is Messi private jetting around America for the games, arriving separately from the team, with his
bodyguard?
His medical team.
DePaul. Yeah.
Actually, did you see a mad one there during the week? Casemiro's is signing with Inter Milan. But there's this stat, or there's this rule in America that if you put him on a watch list, so LA Galaxy had Casemiro on a watch list to say that they were looking at buying him.
Yeah.
And now, because Inter Miami's after swooping in to take him, they have to now pay Inter Miami have to pay LA Galaxy royalties for Casemiro.
That's so American.
Isn't that so American? As if it was a draft.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like this guy, you've never heard of him. He's like, you know, below the radar at Manchester United, Real Madrid, and the captain of Brazil for one of the tournaments. He might have been. It is. Football in America is all a bit mad, but it does seem to have taken off this World Cup. The viewership figures are higher than the NBA finals.
Yeah, there's a lot to not like about the World Cup and all that for sure, but it like on the television, even like just the aesthetic of it. The stadiums are unbelievable.
And they're packed.
Yeah,
Single game. Yeah. Like you're looking at it at NFL games. And the NFL games look insane, but it's come across so well, I thought.
Yeah, it has. Yeah, I've been watching Bosnia, and we were talking about this morning. I watched a bit of Bosnia and Switzerland last week, and I don't know what stadium it was in. I don't know. Was it in LA maybe? But it was ridiculous.
I think that was in Dallas.
Was it in Dallas?
It was the Dallas Cowboys Stadium.
Yeah, but I just remember thinking, like, how have they managed to get 70, 80,000 people in to watch Bosnia against Switzerland and it not look in any way sort of.
There's no public transport to the stadium either.
I don't know, it's crazy. I expected to see an awful lot of empty stadiums.
I haven't seen one.
Speaking of the times of these games, I actually went to bed and said, I'm not watching any more of this Bosnia-Switzerland game on 68 minutes. There were 5 goals after the 70th minute. And it still was somehow a bad game.
I don't even think that game was on that late. You just had an early night.
It was the 1982 World Cup that Diego Maradona scored.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, yeah.
5 goals at the 86 tournament.
I'm just going to run through the paper headlines for you very quickly here. Hail the Messiah. Argentina star becomes all-time leading World Cup scorer after a double and even misses a penalty. That's the back of the Mail. City close to sealing deal for Maresca. They've been doing this deal for Enzo Maresca for about a year, it feels like. And there's wrangling over the 10 million compensation. Chelsea are going to expect money because obviously Maresca told them that City had been in to chat to him, and then they were like, well, why don't you marry him then? He was like, well, I will. And then they all fell out, and so now they are getting married for 10 million apparently. Leinster's new boss hunt, speculation that it could be O'Gara, it could be Noel McNamara, it could be Johnny Sexton, it could be Stuart Lancaster, could it be Joe Schmidt? I don't know. If you're a Leinster fan, give us your thoughts about who will be the Leinster, the best of that selection, and anybody else. Maybe Jacques Nienaber gets the job as well. And then there's reaction to the draw last night about how Ger Brennan and Cian Brannock McGinn are going to meet each other again, hopefully have a very public handshake at the start of it in front of everybody. Look, we're friends. 12 weeks, you bastards. Jude ready for big stage, says Tuchel. This is obviously the England game. This is tonight, right?
Yeah.
9 o'clock.
Yeah.
And it's on BBC. So for those of us who don't have the extra channels for the ITV thing, you get to watch it on BBC tonight. Tuchel's talking about Bellingham and how they've managed to damp down essentially all the egos. He's done a good job. But it's a one game. Everybody's getting a bit carried away in England.
Yeah, he's done a good job up to now. That's the thing with the England job. You're always doing a good job until you're not.
Yeah.
And very quickly you cannot.
Very fickle.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
Getting especially rid of the big egos, I think, having seen some of Harry Maguire in the aftermath of not being selected for this World Cup, both on Twitter and then also on the Restless Football podcast, I think Tuchel actually did the right job there if he was trying to get rid of an ego, because by God, he has one. And he talked himself out of a World Cup place. Like, the likelihood is with Livramento's injury, he would have potentially come in as the extra man if he had kept his mouth shut.
Do you see him selling World Cup stickers out of a New York hut?
No.
What?
They had him selling World Cup stickers, or some company must have employed him. He was selling stickers out of you like the New York bagel huts.
Yeah,
he was selling World Cup stickers out of that.
Yeah,
I said to myself, this man, and because it was so true. You know, like if Konza or if Gay or if Stones picks up an injury, and which Stones is likely to do, you're looking at a centre half to come back in. It's never going to be Harry Maguire.
Not now.
Not in a million years are you ringing up, and especially after the talk out of him as well.
He obviously had it in him. Tuchel must have spotted this, right? Because one of the things was Tuchel didn't even consider sticking Trent back in. He was like, you're just going to keep asking me these stupid questions and I'm going to get annoyed answering your same stupid questions again and again. So he didn't even bother. I think it's the same with Maguire. It's like, oh, Harry Maguire, you know, you might want him to come up for the end of it. No, I don't. It's my team.
I kind of respect him doubling down on the Trent one. Like, it's not even that he doesn't think Trent is a good player, it's that he doesn't want the English media chatting about it the entire tournament. And I suppose that probably does impact on the team and gets into the dressing room and gets into the players as well.
I think on that point then as well, I think that the way that he's picked his team and his selection, like, I know they were talking about the lack of experience, but that means that there's a lack of baggage. Like, how many, like, think back of Harry Maguire and Trent and Phil Foden and all these guys that are carrying such baggage from previous tournaments and nearly being there. But then you look at the likes of, like, Konsa coming in, you look at the likes of,
Elliot
Anderson coming into the middle. Like, no baggage whatsoever. You're looking at these guys and then you obviously have the top performers of Harry Kane, Jude Bellingham, that these kind of tournaments don't phase it. So I love what he's doing with England and how he's prepping it, and the lack of experience, yes, but lack of baggage also.
The Anthony Barry stuff at halftime was interesting.
Yeah.
A bit of tough love. The players apparently were like, no, that's what it's like. We always get that kind of level of feedback.
He also got a bit of backlash from that as well.
He did, but from
the English media.
Yeah. And
they thought he was playing himself into a job there. That was a pre-job interview. I think it's just a guy doing his job, I said. And that's what Anthony Barry, I mean, he seems to be very good at his job.
I think he's incredibly well regarded by everyone who's ever come.
It's like he's going to get a job somewhere if he wants a job.
I don't think the halftime interview is what the hiring process is like in top level football.
I actually remember years ago, he was actually at Wigan. Anthony Barry was Paul Cook that was managing Sligo. Paul Cook was managing Wigan, and Anthony Barry was like, I don't really know what he was. He was just part of the coaching staff. And when Frank Lampard got the Chelsea job, he came and said, I want him.
Right.
And Wigan were in administration at the time. And not a fear of Chelsea throwing him a few quid for him.
Like, no, didn't need to.
No.
And that works.
Yeah, he's gone from strength to strength.
Capitalism, baby.
Yeah, listen.
Messi out on his own at the back of the Indo this morning. Contepomi, McNamara and O'Gara on Leinster shortlist. And then Galway and Dubs, the headline last night, weekend in Croker. So Kerry again on GA Plus. Kerry Tyrone, 6:15 on Saturday evening. Cork versus Mayo at 4 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. Sunday, it's Louth Monaghan at 1:45. And Dublin and Galway are at 4 o'clock. And then the other news that came through with Mark O'Connor is not coming back to play football for Kerry. So he's going to do these 2 years. He's got another 2 years in his contract, and then he'll come back for the 5 in a row. That's what's going to happen.
This will be the fourth Kerry game in a row now. Fourth Kerry game in a row on GA Plus. So
it's outrageous. Outside of the Munster final, we might get all Ireland champions that were on TV twice throughout the year, on terrestrial TV, I should say.
Don't take away from the Munster final now. Provincials are great.
Most final turned out. Oh no, sorry, it was a very one-sided.
But like, it is a bit outrageous. Like, if you think about the grand scheme of I brought up the David Clifford stat yesterday. Like, it's outrageous that we're robbing certain people of seeing David Clifford as absolute pomp in an unbelievable Kerry team.
Kids specifically,
yeah. You should be able to watch him at any stage.
There is the
and
point.
You should watch him at any stage. You get the chance to, because we're watching greatness unfold as we speak.
Yeah.
But a lot of people are not watching it because they can't.
I think you actually said it yesterday about the fact that Kerry have been on it so often that the yearly subscription might actually be most value for money for them.
I quipped that somebody should look, and I might do it after the show. So somebody it wasn't supposed to be me, but I might do it anyway. Somebody should look at the cost per game based on the amount of times your team features on GAA Plus, because Kerry fans are definitely getting the best value for money out of that subscription.
Kildare fans can't complain too much. You need to play well to do it. Got to pick it up. Gaffers do better. Rally cry. This is, you know, we were good. Samasuka, but not that good. And then all the rest of it. Pico still in the back of the papers because obviously that was the night before. Tuchel goes on the defensive to solve back issues. He says they were dropping into a low block too early in that first half, which is essentially, I think, what Anthony Barry was saying at halftime. And then I just want to get into the... So these are the hurling structures pieces, which are in every paper. The Examiner's three of them. The Irish Times, hurling's ecosystem is fragile. The sport can't afford another year like this. This is Dennis Walsh's piece today. He's talking about first off, the head high tackling, which we might come to a little bit later on as well, and then the match not starting on telly because of the Donegal Dublin game going into extra time, but essentially making the point that Hurling's new advisory group has no brief to review the championship structure, and maybe there's no stomach in Croke Park or elsewhere to jeopardise the extraordinary income from the Munster Championship. But there's a suggestion of a structure here which will keep everybody alive, right? A former inter-county manager, he doesn't say who, but I'd say it's probably few enough of them who you might suspect it would be. A former inter-county manager has made a suggestion based on the playoff system in American college football. McDonagh Cup winners get added as 12 seeds, and then there's a preliminary quarter-final stage. Provincial championships decide the rankings for the All-Ireland series, but nobody gets eliminated. So, provincial finalists go straight to All-Ireland quarterfinals with home advantage. The other eight teams in each province would play off according to their finishing position. The makeup of the semi-finals would be determined by an open draw. So this year, after the Leinster and Munster championships, you would have had Kilkenny versus Tip, Waterford versus Wexford, Offaly versus Laois, and Clare versus Kildare as preliminary quarterfinals. And the argument against this is like, oh, you're rewarding teams who've been beaten already in the championship. But to Kieran McGeaney's point about the round robin, what you're doing is you're giving everybody more games in summer, and they're training on, and there at least is an opportunity for them to match the superpowers who it seems are getting further and further away. That's Dennis's piece, the back of the... Will I go through these first before you get the other views? You want some of them? Yeah, okay. Back of the Examiner, something's got to give to awaken hurling from its midsummer lull, is Kieran Shannon's piece. He has a separate one, cross-provincial round robins that start from St. Patrick's Day. So you keep your provincials, but you run a separate competition, and essentially you're allowing teams back that way. And just making the point that Waterford and Wexford, it's barren at the moment, no Tip, no Kilkenny. And this is like, this is an all-time low because you haven't had any of those teams playing well. And John Fogarty on his... this is the inside GA. Is the forum different? I'm not sure. But he's saying a humbling hour for hurling, and talking about how it's unlikely that they're going to move away from the Munster Championship being having the knockout element to it because they make so much money from the 8.3 million in gate receipts. But he is also saying that Derek Kent was talking, he's the GAA president-elect. It's all out in quarter-final weekend and it's all about football. He's making the point that hurling is getting swamped by the football, even on All-Ireland quarterfinal weekend, because the quarterfinals are blowouts. And there's two more pieces in the Examiner. Sorry, there's one more. It's Patrick Horgan, but that's specifically about the Leinster Championship not being any good anymore and how he doesn't think... in fairness, I think Galway are a good bit ahead of Offaly and Dublin, and the semi-final with Cork will be a very competitive game, but the Leinster Championship doesn't appear to have served them well in terms of being match-ready for the All-Ireland series, which is essentially saying... Galway's goose is cooked.
It's a foregone conclusion.
What do you think of this?
So I suppose, firstly, on the point in terms of, I don't think Munster's reliant on Munster being knockout whatsoever. I think Munster is going to garner the respect and the attendances and being that cash cow for the GAA, regardless of whether Munster's knockout or not. In terms of, like, I think back to Waterford this year, would Waterford's championship have been served better if they played longer into the championship? Would Waterford have gotten better as the championship went on, or if they got more opportunities? I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I don't think so. I think that Waterford started really, really good and competitively against Clare. Could have got over the line there. But there were so many could-haves. Like, you had three probably could-haves throughout that season for Waterford to have won games. Probably the Clare game, probably the Cork game, probably the Limerick game. And could potentially have gotten over the line in any of those if they had maybe had a little bit of a deeper squad. But if that championship went on, were Waterford ever going to get over the line? Was it always going to be a foregone conclusion that Waterford were getting knocked out of the championship? I would say...
So that's this year, right?
Yeah.
Would they benefit from having another month of hurling as a group and a squad next year?
100%. That's the other argument in for it, is that Waterford people aren't like in the month of, they were knocked out in May.
Yeah. So whatever about not being able to see David Clifford on telly, Waterford hurling supporter
whatsoever
has a day out, or you're not getting in the car, you're not loading the sandwiches up, you're not going off, and there's no stories of the team and the naughties for the kids in the back of the car. It's just, now it's over.
It's over and that's it. And it's now, okay, who's the next team? Can we support the Galway, or can we support the Limerick, or whoever it might be? I see the Watford football manager coming out and saying that I know there's a lot of dual players down in Watford and would they be better served playing football for Watford because they'd have a longer season playing football for Watford. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And I suppose hurling's probably the disparity between the upper echelon of the hurling teams, the top four, and I think that the top four that are there right now are probably the best on merit that should be there in terms of Limerick, Clare, Galway and Cork. But the disparity between that and what sits below that is huge. And you saw that at the weekend with Offaly. Like, I watched Liam Sheedy and Joe Kenning and they were saying, you know, it was a really successful year for Offaly hurling. How was that a successful year for Offaly? Getting the trouncing that they did and having to go back and say, like, you look at Johnny Kelly coming back and, you know, that was a really, you know, we had done everything right coming into it and, you know, we expected a bit. That was in no way, shape or form was that, could Offaly take any positive from that game? Like, none whatsoever. To get that much of a hiding against Cork, how was that a successful season? Kilkenny were miles off of this year. So by default, Offaly are this year, 2026, the third best team in Leinster. But that's only because there was no one, that was the three teams, Kilkenny were never going to be there or thereabouts. And if Kilkenny were that bit more on it, potentially a percent better than they were, Offaly wouldn't have been there. It would have been Kilkenny in that third place play, or position. So I just think that the disparity between the top teams and the middle teams is so big. I think that's what needs to be looked at. Like, you can talk about the structure, yeah, the structure, but like, even if you go back to your point, Joe, in terms of those preliminary quarterfinals, the reason we got rid of those preliminary quarterfinals and that Joe McDonagh team coming into it was because it was an absolute trouncing and you saw that again. And now it's now gone from the preliminary quarterfinals to the quarterfinals. Dublin getting hockey by Clare and Offaly getting hockey by Cork. So now you are they going to next year get rid of the quarterfinals? What's the solution?
I don't know.
It's in, and I genuinely believe it's in a real crisis. It's in a real crisis.
I think one of the points Charlotte Burns was making is that they're trying to think very long term about this. So he was making the example of Armagh. I think they have 8 hurling clubs and he thinks they need to have 20 before they'd be able to be competitive in the second or third tier. And that is all true, right? But in the meantime, are we staring down the barrel of a Limerick a Limerick Cork for the next couple of years? Or did Tipperary just have a bad year this year? Like, is it more pronounced because Tip were awful and actually their playing stock is strong enough? There'll be a new Kilkenny manager who comes in and presumably there'll be some kind of a bounce. Like last year, Tipperary and Kilkenny played out in All-Ireland semi-final that went down to the wire. Tipperary won it in controversial circumstances because the scoreboard didn't tell Kilkenny what the crack was. And then Tipperary went and won the All-Ireland final. They're out of this championship this year. If they were both playing in quarterfinals this weekend, would the games have been closer and better? I mean, I'm sure Cork would have run the score up happily on Kilkenny and revelled in it, but I don't think it would have been as bad as it was.
No, it wouldn't have been as bad, but those teams that you're talking about, like Kilkenny are a team, whoever comes in, they're in a massive transition, like huge transition. So they're not going to be, I feel they're not going to be competitive for 2, 3, 4 years. So I think Tipperary are a team in transition. I think Tipperary will be looking hard and fast at the squad, the panel members that they have. And you can't expect new players to come in and automatically be competing yet again. Yeah, they'll be definitely competitive, but in terms of competing for Munster and All-Ireland success, I don't think so. Watford, from what I was surprised that Peter Queeley stepped away because I felt like he was after maybe blooding a couple of those young players into the Watford squad, but again, will take a couple of years. So I think that we are a couple of years down the line from it being a competitive championship again. And I look at the football championship and I see what they've done. And I feel like hurling is falling behind because of a lack of want, maybe not a lack of want, but a lack of understanding that the game is where it is, a lack of realisation of where we're at with hurling. Sometimes you bury your head in the sand because the crowds are massive and like you look at the games over the last weekend, I know Owen touched on it on the evening show yesterday, that Cork and Offaly carried the largest spectator viewing in the whole games across those 8 games across the weekend. They had the higher viewership that was there that paid into the game.
So everything is fine.
So that's what I'm saying. So everything is fine. There's people going to watch those games. But the quality isn't there whatsoever. But are the GAA looking at it that it's, we're making money, so that's all fine? I think the game itself, and there's an awful lot of traditionalists that will look at the game and we can't change it. The game has been this way for hundreds of years, but it's got to a stage now where, like back then, there was teams that were competing and anyone could have won it. Whereas now it's got to a stage where you're talking, there's potentially 4 teams, if not 3, that are potentially going to win the All-Ireland this year.
Is hurling actually in a crisis, or is it just that Gaelic football is better at the minute? Because like if you look through the last decade, like all it takes is 1 year for hurling to be exceptional from quarterfinal onwards, and people talk about it as if it's the greatest sport in the world again, and God, Gaelic football could learn a thing or two about hurling, and people lavishing in Gaelic football finally being off the telly so that we could watch the hurling and get into a proper sport. Whereas I think that like this is the first year that you can properly say Gaelic football has overtaken hurling in terms of popular viewership and popular coverage in terms of where the game is at. But it almost feels like next year we could have a completely different conversation about hurling because we get four cracking games throughout the championship. Is it not just that maybe Gaelic football's better and hurling people are pushing the panic button too early?
I think personally that for hurling you have those 3-4 games of the season and they're cracker games and it glosses over everything else. Do you know, it puts that shiny gloss on it to say that, oh, you think back to, and they're usually the semi-finals that are the cracking games, like even last year. But the rest of the championship wasn't that way. And football, I think the rule changes in football have made, because think back the years gone by, it was always football was the lesser cousin or the less thought of cousin to hurling, because it was so dull and dour and it was hand pass and this and that, and Jim McGuinness won an All-Ireland by hand passing the ball, and that was what it was. But this rule change has reinvigorated, brought new life to it, and I think the structural changes that they've brought in have brought new life to it. And you're looking to it and you're like, oh, there's nothing at play, there's no knockout. But then you get the weekend just gone and it's like this absolute animal of a competition comes into play.
Yeah.
And you're looking at games and just absolute crackers. Mayo Mead, I looked at that game, like it was insane. It was insane to watch the standard, like David Clifford down in Killarney. Hurling hasn't had that at all this season.
No.
A dour Leinster final, a dour Munster final, two dour quarterfinals, and you're looking into semifinals saying, please God, let one of these games be a cracker, because if it's not, you're looking into a real bad championship. And I think that that's the trend that we'll probably see going forward if something doesn't change drastically.
I think the worry is that the kind of traditional powerhouses that we've become accustomed to seeing at the end of championships in Kilkenny, I know Tipperary won it last year, but it remains to be seen whether this year is the outlier or last year is the outlier, in that are Tipperary actually on the level of Cork and Limerick on a consistent basis, I suppose, and this year they haven't been able to back it up, but again they never really do back it up when they do go and win in All-Ireland. On the attendance thing, like the attendances are good as far as Cork and Limerick go, really, but the other game the weekend was Dublin and Clare, and there was absolutely no one at that. There was 12,000 people, I think, at that game. So you can interpret that whatever way you want. There's obviously the fact that Offaly haven't been at this stage of an All-Ireland in so long that people will turn out for that because it's new, and it's like, oh, well, look, you never know, Dublin beat Limerick last year.
Yeah, but if they were to, if that game was to be played again next year, we expect that result would persist next year. Might be a tiny bit closer.
Yeah.
But Cork are good at beating.
Yeah, for sure. Anyway, point I'm trying to make is I don't actually think it's anything to do with Gaelic football. It's obviously an easier mark to have to look at Gaelic football and go, this is in such a great spot, hurling's not in such a great spot. And the marker would have been years gone by that hurling is superior and it's much more enjoyable and all that sort of stuff. So it's easy to make the comparison. But I think two things can be true. I think there is just a subpar hurling championship going on at the minute that happens to coincide with one of the better Gaelic football championships we've had in quite some time, and that really does come down to the fact that the playing field just seems to be so level outside of Kerry until we see kind of how good they really are. But
I think the main thing, and John Fogarty's kind of picked up on this, is that there's loads of football matches that people are interested in, and obviously there are way more counties that play football to a high standard than there are. So that's like the original sin, is that not enough counties play hurling at a very high level. But where's this piece now? Sorry, who's saying it? He's quoting somebody here, so forgive me. But getting rid of two largely meaningless games is the easy part, but the Hurling Development Committee don't appear to realise there's more to it than that. I think it's actually, he's quoting himself. There'll be just 5 senior inter-county fixtures after that provincial final weekend. Football, on the other hand, will have 55 games between Sam Maguire and Talton Cup. And it's Talton Cup semi-finals were classics.
The Wicklow Offaly game was unbelievable.
So there are counties who are interested in showing up to those, but 11 times the number of games seems slightly imbalanced. I'm not a mathematician, but 5 versus 55.
5 games.
I think that's insane when you talk it out like that.
Yeah.
Because obviously your Joe McDonough winners and losers don't progress now. So 5 games versus 55.
Well, I think the fact that we're having quarterfinals in June as well is like, or like the third week in June probably is telling to that as well.
Yeah, but I don't buy that narrative then as well of like, if you push it back 2 weeks and push the Ireland finals back into August, does that doesn't next or near fix the problem.
Mm.
Do you know, and even the likes of, you know, people that were saying that, oh, if you're Watford, Tipperary gone to the championship in May, what's that? Okay, that's fine. I understand that narrative from them. But in terms of the championship being better, like to my initial point, them hurling longer into the season wasn't going to change their season.
No.
You know, like, you need those counties need to be better, and you need more better counties. In simple terms, you need counties to be better to make a more competitive championship. And it goes back to that football point. You have Westmead, who are coming from nowhere to win Leinster and to be competitive in the All-Ireland series.
And McGeaney would point out they won Tailteann and the next year went up and had those three games deeper into the summer. Now, they lost them all by point, I think.
Yeah,
they were competitive and then they would go back down and then they come back up. So I buy your point that this year's Waterford team weren't going to benefit from that, but maybe the new manager comes in next year and goes, actually, you guys had two extra games and you played some hurling in June and you stuck around as a group and something happened. We discovered something in those games. And so there's like a slow incremental benefit. And the other side of that is that the other teams continue to get better and better and better and the gap widens. So
more games, yeah.
I think they're all suggesting that that's like a tiny part of the solution. But you've no qualms about the Munster Championship not having any bearing on the All-Ireland Series. You think as a standalone competition, it'll continue to have the magic that it has at the minute.
100%.
See, I think you're largely right.
100%. Yeah, if you take the drop out of
the knockout, I don't think the knockout matters at all.
It doesn't at all. At all. Because you're still going to have people that go on a summer's May afternoon going out to watch these teams because it's what you've done. That's not going to...
We love the thing that we do, 100%. Whether or not there is something...
100%. 100%.
I think it definitely applies to the Munster Hurling Championship. I'm not sure that it would apply over a long period of time to like some of the provincial football championships, though. I think if you remove the bearing that, you know, like even this year to a degree, that winning your provincial championship was the same reward as far as the All-Ireland Series is concerned, as reaching your provincial final. I think over a long period of time, and you can see it with the likes of like a Tyrone, who obviously were trying to win the Ulster Championship, went out that little bit early and seemed to be one of the fresher teams in the competition at the minute and have gotten further into the All-Ireland Series than Armagh, who went on and won it. Granted, Armagh played Kerry, now Tyrone will play Kerry and in all likelihood will probably lose and the same outcome might happen. But I think if you do remove the carrot of winning your provincial championship being a benefit to your All-Ireland Series run, I think over time teams will stop taking it seriously. But I don't think that'll happen in the Munster Hurling Championship. I think it's an entity of its own, really, isn't it? It's that already. Even though winning it gets you straight into an All Ireland semi final, it doesn't matter.
No. But and even in keeping that that carrot of winning the Munster. But I also think we forget about the league phase, and I know Jar, I've spoken about this with yourself and Colin before, but having some sort of a carrot and some sort of a prize for winning the league as well, having that have a bearing on your championship season as well, whether that be, I know they got rid of the preliminary quarterfinals, but having that as a carrot maybe as a quarterfinal.
Yeah.
Well, that would have been a backdoor way for teams to really go early, go at that, and then the Munster Championship is a free hit, but you know you're guaranteed to be in it. And like I think any of that kind of stuff would be helpful.
100%, because again, and then therefore what you're doing is you're having maybe not the drop in Munster come championship, but you're having that onus on teams to go for the league, and then now all of a sudden you have that league that actually means something and teams going for that and saying, do you know what, we're a really young team, let's have a crack off this league phase and let's see what comes of that and potentially win that league and have something to look forward to come championship and be guaranteed to be hurling beyond June. Would that be a carrot for Waterford, Tipperary to be looking at?
Yeah.
Could be something to return to when we talk more in depth about hurling now in the next half an hour. But we do have some big World Cup news to talk about as well, Ger.
Go for it.
So England taking on Ghana this evening. And the Ghanaian witch doctor, Nana Bonsum, has said that he is going to put a hex on Harry Kane ahead of the game. Now, he has come out and said, very sound of him, he's not wishing him any serious injury. but he's hoping that it'll be enough to stop him from doing the work against his country. He has said that he believes in his powers, that he said he's very good at predictions, and that he's going to do his best to prevent Harry Kane from doing any damage to his country. He said that he worked against Cristiano Ronaldo in 2014. He did put a hex on him to get an injury. So he's not doing the same to Harry Kane, apparently. And thankfully, another man has jumped up to England's defence. Yuri Geller, friend of the show.
Yes.
Who is famous for his spoon bending, and also believe he said that he made the ball move for Gary McAllister's penalty. Was it at the 2004 Euros or 2002 World Cup?
I think it was not Euro 96.
Is
it Euro 96?
It wasn't in the 2000s.
Some claim it was in a helicopter.
Yeah, he was in a helicopter. He made a move.
The game.
Anyway, he said that he's going to counteract this hex, and he's going to use his vibrations and his energy to bring goodwill to Harry Kane in his match.
We've done some bad things in our time, but one of the things that we did was in the middle of Mayo's great run was we got Yuri Geller on to try and break the Mayo curse.
That's crazy.
He was delighted to be on. He was delighted. James Horan was not happy with us. I think it took him many years to forgive us, and I'd like to have formally apologised to James Horan for being such a shower of bastards.
I don't like any of this stuff, though.
You scared of it?
Not that I'm scared of it. I'd just rather not have anything to do with it.
There's 96, yeah, against John.
There are deep, dark forces here we're messing with. It's like...
Like
the Lord of the Rings when they're going through the forest.
Yuri Geller, the witch doctor here. If I was Harry Kane, I'd be careful. I wouldn't be interacting with any of that.
So you don't believe in it?
It's not that I don't believe in it. I'd just rather not have anything to do with
it.
I don't want anything to do with it. So stop asking about it.
Now we're interested. Keep going.
The whole witch doctor thing is quite an interesting story if you actually look into it in African football and domestic football. Like, there are active scouts that go around the country looking for witch doctors to bring to their clubs so that they can be part of their setup and be an active part. And it's something they genuinely believe in. It's been banned in the AFCON, obviously, because of this.
So when you say it's been banned, specifically they'll blow dust on the pitch or something?
Specifically, there is a rule that you are not allowed, teams are not allowed a witch doctor as part of their setup. And you can be punished for having one as part of your team, putting spells on the other teams.
Sports psychology is grand, though.
Yeah, I think it's a big one. One to keep an eye on.
One to watch.
Let's say with Harry Kane tonight. I think people will be watching Harry Kane more closely tonight.
I tell you, if something happens to Harry Kane tonight,
the heebie-jeebies. Do we want to take some Tim Vickery as well? He obviously is the voice of South America, and Messi breaking the scoreline or breaking the goal record. I mean, who better to talk about it than Tim Vickery? He was on the football show last night.
No sound on that, sorry about that.
He was saying great things.
Yeah, no, I'm sure he was, and you should definitely go and listen back to it on our pages. But I was watching, they had him on, I think, BBC maybe last night, in the immediate aftermath of the win, and he was talking about Messi. Like, Tim Vickery, as he does, like, great, like, soliloquy, referencing all sorts of stuff from the under-17 World Cup maybe he saw, or when Messi was 17 playing at an under-20 tournament in South America, and all this sort of stuff. And he went on for 4, 5, 6 minutes, went on for ages, and... they had the screen kind of on him. He's obviously in Brazil, wherever he's living, and they have the full screen on him, and he's talking, and someone obviously gets in Gabby Logan's ear and says, we have to move on here, we have to, you know, we've got bigger things to talk about, even though Messi's after scoring 2 goals at a World Cup, potentially his last. So she kind of butts in a bit, and he's like, accepts it, you know, I've gathered it, I need to move on here, we're done. And it comes back to Gabby Logan, and she goes, absolutely, Tim, brilliant stuff, thanks a million. Unfortunately, we do have to move on, because in just under 24 hours, England are going to be taking on Ghana, and they cut to a promo for the England-Ghana game. You know, couldn't have given Tim another 90 seconds to finish out his point, considering they didn't have any ads to go to either, but I don't know, it's just quite English, I thought.
I think we have the sound fixed if we want to give Tim the time to finish his thought.
We're coming close to the end. No, I don't want this to end. I want to keep on living in a Lionel Messi world. But in the race between the athlete and time, there's only ever one winner. And surely he can't go on at the highest level much beyond this, can he? Surely he can't go on. But he's astounding us all with what he's doing already. But I do think we are surely at the end. So let's bring every little last drop out of it. And I still worry about their attempts to defend their title. And history says that it's very, very difficult to do. And so far, defensively, they haven't been bad. I mean, there was one goal Algeria scored that was disallowed for a narrow offside. Apart from that, I think real shots in anger after these first two games. Martinez only really had one shot to save, the free kick from Sabitzer from Austria. But I do worry about the defensive unit. And so far, Argentina haven't come up against any of the outstanding individual talent, which is flowering so welcomingly in this World Cup. Because I'll be interested to see, well, on someone like, for example, Diomande of Ivory Coast, who looks a fantastic player, what would he do against this Argentina defence that they haven't managed to renew since the last World Cup? So I think when we get into the knockout stages, there will be a sense of jeopardy about Argentina that we haven't seen so far.
Dressed as the man from Del Monte there as well. What a jacket.
He's the best dressed man on television. He always dresses sharply. There was one night it was in the middle of a heat wave in Brazil, and he, I'd say, did a topless on off the ball.
All right. Yeah.
There's that.
Will live long in my memory. He did mention Yan Diomande there, and I don't know if people have seen this, but he did a Players Chronicle interview. Well worth a read. Fantastic and heartbreaking in many ways. He speaks about his sister and how she was his biggest fan growing up, and they always dreamed of being famous and him taking his family to far-flung places, and she died at 15. Poisoned. She was poisoned, and they never found out what happened or who did it or Jesus. Whatever. So yeah, it's a tough read, but I think most people came out of reading it thinking, I'm going to be a fan of Diomande for the rest of my life now. He seems to be on his way to Liverpool potentially this summer, as well as Mo Salah's replacement. So
100-odd million they're talking about. Yeah,
something like that. So it's well worth having a look. He was really good for Ivory Coast as well, but probably not their standout player over the tournament so far. But I think he'll spring into life at some stage. Mm.
If they can get through.
Yeah, they're in a bit of trouble, aren't they? Mm. Well, the last game was relatively straightforward.
They beat Ecuador, didn't they? So they might actually be all right. It's at least one of your third place finishes. They have to play, who's there in Curacao? They'll be all right. They should get through, yeah.
Yeah, Curacao not totally useless. And also...
Not totally useless, no, of course not. But they've already got 3 points, so... They should. I suppose, unless they lose to Curacao, and anyway.
Who are the GAA equivalents of Messi and Ronaldo still doing it? Does TJ count at 38?
Yeah,
TJ definitely counts. Yeah,
TJ.
What is it, Paul Conroy? 37.
Yeah, Paul Conroy counts. Man, he's a baller. He's unbelievable. I don't know. Yeah, it's. Ooh, that's a great question. That
Tadhg Morley.
Yeah.
Shane O'Donnell.
He's still young.
He's 32,
33.
He's only a guy soon.
John Conlon? Prematurely aged Tadhg Morley there as well. He's only 32. John Conlon.
What age is Tadhg Morley?
2032.
Tadhg Morley's been around hasn't he? He's been around youngs.
That's what it's saying 32. Here.
32. Yeah.
According to AI Overview, which may or may not be accurate, so.
I think he's probably in around that, I'd imagine. AI Overview. The ever reliable.
God, I thought Tony Kelly was older than he is.
Sure, he was 17 when he won.
I'm aging all these players.
Michael Murphy, I suppose.
He was 21 when he won hurt earlier, I think, was he?
Michael Murphy, I guess, yeah.
Hello. What age is Murphy?
I think he's 37, 38.
Yeah, 37. That he definitely.
36, born on 4th of August, would be 37. It would have been All Ireland final weekend.
I guess you could say that maybe last year.
I'm forgetting the key man, John Heslin.
John Hez, yes, absolutely. I think
that's a really good question.
It's only about 34, I think, but yeah.
Somebody in the comments, let us know.
Hez definitely counts. I'm having that one. Well done.
All the Monaghan boys have retired. Darren Hughes.
Jack McCarron is.
Carl O'Connell and Conor McManus, obviously, they would all have been 39, 38, 38. So I don't know. They're Quibing, them slacking off, not playing this year.
Paul Gainey,
yeah, good shout.
Not a bad shot. Mm. Maybe he hasn't reached the absolute heights. We're kind of just naming old
Gainey's
players.
35.
35. Like,
Paul Guinea's a fantastic player, but I'm not sure he was ever the best player in the country, was he?
He'll be 36.
But it's Rory Began. And he's a goalkeeper.
Oh, yeah, Began. I think Began was going to be 32 when he was making it in the. He's not that old. Began 34.
Yeah.
They can have another 10 years doing that, couldn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. You bring him on for the kick.
But he stroked him over from the 65.
Stroked about four of them over. It's killer.
Donny Smith's line out yesterday was fantastic. He said he was watching the US Open and watching Began was he was taking out the pitching wedge and flopping it over the bar.
That's ridiculous.
There's no backlift at all. It's just pure. It's just. I assume it's because his legs are just so powerful. Yeah. It's just pure technique. There's no. He doesn't try. He doesn't kick the ball. He just throws his leg at it. Like it's just.
There is.
He has aim. It's ridiculous.
Special about it. But yeah. There's the Cork Minor goalkeeper. Have you seen this guy?
Yeah.
Pinging them over from basically the halfway line.
It's a two-year. Something like that, I think. Yeah, he's clipping them over from all sorts, all angles.
They're going to be in the All-Ireland final because they beat Derry in the semi. So,
Minor.
Yeah.
The guy's like 17.
But there was some of the, like, was it Louth against Kildare in the Minor last year? There was guys pinging it over. They're obviously just practicing it now because they've seen it. And
Westmead's Minor guy, Taylor Slevin, I think his name is, he's doing the same thing. He was pinging from 60 odd yards. Like,
yeah. Well, I mean, there's a bit of a pathway now if you are really young.
Oh, yeah, tight
in
leader.
That if you stand out at 16, 17 at doing that, you'll get scouted and brought into NFL training or...
Well, you go to college in America for 4 years and have the time of your life.
Exactly, yeah. There's a young lad over there now currently playing for a D1 team.
Right. There's a load of them.
Yeah.
There actually is loads of them, yeah.
We did the... Did you win it? Competition?
I won it, yeah. Yeah.
The kicking competition?
Showed you up big time, yeah.
I didn't get the opportunity to take part in that.
Yeah, they didn't scout me though.
Oh, well, there's going to be another one this year.
Is there, yeah?
Would you be interested in a career?
100%.
Yeah, okay, well, you can be part of this, definitely, yeah.
I'm going to take my crown here. What's all this about?
Did you play football?
I do, yeah. Claim to fame. Club, Munster, semi-final, played against David Clifford and Paddy Clifford.
All right.
Yeah,
Really?
Fiona Casaman played for us in our home pitch. It was... chock-a-block. They stopped at the gates. It's the only time we were ever. So I was marking Paddy Clifford.
What?
And it was an eye-opening experience, to say the least. It was insane. So we
did he talk as a matter of interest?
They just missed their team holiday. So the Kerry had won the All-Ireland that year. And they had...
I remember that.
Yeah, so they won they won out the All-Ireland. Hockey just by like 25 points. Like Dave was inside and he didn't want to know about it, and then we clawed it back to like I think there was like 4 points in it, and next thing Paddy just turned into this animal and sprayed like four outside of the boot passes into David, and he just caught them and scored like 2-3 in the blink of an eye, and then they whipped him off and it was insane. But like, do you know when I always think this about other sports, so I always say, and no disrespect to rugby, and Gordon Darcy's going to be sitting beside me, so don't show him this, but I always said to myself, if you were a high performing athlete playing hurling, football, whatever it might be, and if you dedicated yourself for 2 years, could you make it as a professional rugby player? And I always said to myself, yeah. So I fancied myself, I always said, I could definitely, if you threw me into the Kerry football team, I'd be able to mix it.
Yep.
And that day I was like, oh, there's levels to this game. It was insane. And even like he's moving to like, he was like disinterested, didn't want to know, but I was like, okay, I have him here so I could like take my eyes off him. And next thing he's gone and it's like, oh, it's just insane. It's like the same accuracy that you'd have with Hurley he has with his foot.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
Mm. And does he chat during the match? Is he like, piss out of you?
We were chatting. They had obviously just missed their team holiday, so he was saying that they got a voucher for that and they were going to head away after the...
Oh, so you're just having a normal chat?
So it was just chat.
Yeah.
But then again, like you're chatting and you're like, well, and next thing he's gone and it's like two... slaps two over the bar and trots back out and hits you a dunt and it's like, yeah, so you ain't ready to show. Wow. But that's my claim to fame.
Well, that's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
Tried to mark Paddy Clifford.
And what was your, as a matter, like what was the plan beforehand?
So the plan was my brother Sean was going to mark David, I was going to mark Paddy, and we were going to shut them down and we were going to play our game. As simple as that.
Oh God. We were going to play our game. Send them the other way. Like,
we had no zone because no one tried that before.
No, we were going man on man across the board.
Oh, that's brilliant.
His center of gravity is insane. It's kind of Maradona-esque.
Ridiculous. And I remember at one stage, I remember he was running down the sideline and I said, I'm going to have him here. I'm going to bury him and lay down a marker. And I went to hit him, but like, I ended up falling out over him and he stayed on his feet. Yeah. And I was like, how is he doing this?
What was it? Just a balance.
He's solo to the ground. And if you ever watch, and David's the exact same, if you watch the way he's solo, there's no gap between where they solo the ball and where they catch it again. So you can't even get a hand in. You can't, it's impossible to dispossess them. And then they obviously have both feet. So, I'm tracking his left leg, and next thing he just swings up his right. Mm. There's no way of getting. So, genuinely, not. It's so much respect for inter-county players. And then, you look at teams having to go out, man-mark David Clifford. How do you set about man-marking David Clifford?
I think
genuinely, what goes through a player's head the night before marking to get
you don't sleep, do you?
You don't. No. You can't.
I think everybody has to accept that it's anything less than 1-7. You've done a great job.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
1-7, no freeze conceded. Mm. Great job.
Yeah,
and he hasn't made two goals. You know, so there's 10 points there. The rest of the team's going to have to score 20. Our team's going to have to score 20 and I'm going to keep him to 10.
Yeah.
You do your job, lads.
Successful.
Every time I'm holding them up, somebody come and hit him.
Yeah. There's probably an element of acceptance that, you're not going to get stick regardless of what he scores.
No, that's true.
That's so true. Because there's been so few people that have kept him quiet. And then it's so funny because you do keep him quiet for a half and next thing the second half comes in and he just blasts into life again.
Yeah. Mark from outside has found the highlights of that game, so we might... clip some of that up while I go off there.
We may not show this.